Hi, I'm Carla Nappi, and this is New Books in East Asian Studies. Welcome, and as ever, thank you very much for joining us. I just had the great pleasure of talking with Jay Carter about his new book, Heart of Buddha, Heart of China, The Life of Tan Shu, a 20th Century Monk. This came out with Oxford University Press in 2011, but it was just released as a paperback in 2014, and it's that paperback that we had occasion to talk about today. There are many reasons why this book was a special pleasure for me to read and also to talk with Jay about. One of the things that was so pleasurable about it was the writing style. This is written in a very beautiful and a very empathetic historical voice, and what that does is make it not only a real pleasure to read as a reader, but also makes it a special kind of book to think about when you are thinking about books to assign in a college course, or even perhaps in an upper-level high school course. So it's a very readable and it's a very assignable book as well. It's also a special pleasure because of the sensitivity that Jay brings to his role as a historian and to the craft of historiography. And this is not just in our conversation about the book, but also very much in the flesh of the book itself. So as you'll hear in the course of the conversation to come, there are many points throughout the book where Jay kind of brings us out of the story to consider the ways that the kinds of materials he's working with, the silences in those materials, and the ways that his experience of the spaces of the story really shape the kind of story that results, and also invite us to use the story to think more creatively and to think more broadly about the work of a historian in general. So it's a real contribution to the way we think about and write about and write with the particular problems and opportunities that history writing affords us. It's also a pleasure because the story itself is so gripping. So as you'll hear in the course of the hour to come, Jay takes the life of this particular individual, and you know, we'll talk about, and you'll hear us talking about the difference between a biography and a life, and he uses that to illuminate the transformations and metamorphoses in the life of China over the 20th century. And so the characters in that life include not just this monk Tan Shu, his family, his friends, but also China in its transformations. And in addition to that, a number of really fabulously interesting cities that become characters in the story as well. So this is a book that's going to be of interest if you are a reader of Buddhist history of religion, if you're interested in 20th century China, and also if you just really are interested in lives, the lives of human beings in history. It's a very movingly written account that speaks to all of these subfields of history and writing. So it was a great pleasure, as I've already mentioned. I hope you enjoy the conversation, and I also hope you have a chance to take a look at the book, to read it, especially because it's so convenient now in this new, really wonderfully sized and wonderfully set paperback edition. So thanks for listening and enjoy. I'm here today to talk with James Carter about his new book, Heart of Buddha, Heart of China, The Life of Tan Shu, a 20th Century Monk. And this just came out in a new paperback edition. Welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies, Jay. Thanks for making the time and thanks for writing a book that was really such a pleasure to read, in addition to being something that I learned a lot from. So welcome and thank you.
Thanks for the opportunity.
So Jay, could you start us off by saying, as is traditional for the channel, just a little bit about yourself and your background, and specifically, how did you come to work on the history of modern China?
I think my answer to that question may mirror a lot of people's answers, in that I was in college, I was majoring in history, but I didn't have any particular connection to China. Took a class, got really captured by it, and when I decided that I wanted to try and make a career out of being a historian, and it was really out of being a historian more than being a China scholar, I was encouraged to find historians who wrote the kind of history that I felt, spoke to me, and that would be valuable as not just a student of China, but as a student of history. And that led me into graduate school, and that led me into China studies, and it's kind of taken over from then.
So the book that we're talking about focuses in on the life of one man. This is a Buddhist monk named Tanshu eventually, although we'll get to that naming process perhaps over the course of our conversation. And it uses the life of this one man to open up a window into the lived history of 20th century China more broadly. So it's simultaneously a life of a single man and a life of modern China, or at least aspects of it. How did you come to work on this particular topic and on this figure in particular? You talk about this a little bit at the beginning of the book, but could you talk about this process a little bit for our listeners?
Sure. I mean, the way that the book came about is in many ways the most interesting part of the process. This had grown out of my first book, my dissertation, the dissertation book, which I had done most of the research for in the 90s, and I'd been set up in Harbin, up in the Northeast. And one of the noteworthy things about Harbin is that if you've been there, or even if you haven't been there, it's got a lot of non-Chinese aspects to it. It has a rich Russian past and a European past and Japanese influence. And so when I was there studying language before I even began work on my research, I was taken to the Buddhist temple there. While I was at the Buddhist temple there, I got a hold of a copy of the memoirs of this monk who had founded the temple. And as I got a hold of those memoirs and began to look at them, I found it noteworthy that he had founded temples in some places I was familiar with, some I was less familiar with, but all of them had this connection to a foreign presence in China. And I kind of filed that away as something that I might like to return to after I had written about the rise of nationalism in Harbin in the 1920s, which is what I was specifically researching. So then when I finished that project and time went by, I decided to return to the Tanshu project just to see where it would lead. And at that time, I had visions of writing a pretty academic standard monograph. So the idea was the intersection of Buddhism and nationalism, and how did those two things inform one another? How did they change and shape one another in the 20th century? And as I started to delve into Tanshu's contribution to that, I wound up in this I detail in the prologue. I Googled him because Google hadn't existed when I started doing this in 1994 or 95, and so I Googled him, and up popped this treatise that he'd written. And it turned out this treatise had been translated into English and widely disseminated in the English speaking world. And this wasn't directly related to what I was going to write, but I figured I should have it. So I got in touch with the YMBA, which is actually the Young Men's Buddhist Association, and they sent me a copy. And in the email exchange about that, first they wanted to confirm, you're probably interested in Taishu, right? Because Taishu is a very famous, much more famous figure in 20th century Buddhism. Not Tanshu. I said, no, it's actually Tanshu I'm interested in. And they said, well, in that case, you must know Master Lok To. And I said, why no, I don't. And then to make a long story a little shorter, turns out that Lok To was Tanshu's student. He was his kind of personal secretary for a number of years. He was still alive. And not only was he still alive, he was living in the Bronx, so about an hour's drive from my home. And from conversations with Lok To led me into an entirely different aspect of Tanshu's life and a different way of getting at some of these same issues. So what started off as a very traditional academic project turned into something much more personal and a little bit scary as well as exciting.
And we'll talk about actually more elements of what both what makes this a really important academic study, but also what you identify as differentiating it from the kind of typical experience, or maybe a more typical experience from working on an academic book, certainly over the course of the first couple chapters. And we'll meet also Lok To in more detail by the end of the conversation, as we do meet him toward the end of the book.
Sure.
Now, you mention early in the book as well that this is technically speaking, or to be true to the spirit, perhaps is a better way of putting it, of the book, it's not really a biography in the typical sense of the word. And early on in the book, you talk about the project as you envision it, as you've crafted it, in relation to these categories of biography on the one hand, and on the other hand, microhistory. So especially for those of us who are really interested in the craft of the historian, this is a really, really fascinating thing to bring up, especially so early in the book. Can you talk about that a little bit? How do you think about this in relation to these two categories? And can you bring us into that process further?
Sure. I can try. I think that, I had a lot of trouble exactly describing the book in its early stages because it is a biography in the sense that it's focused on the life of an individual. So, sort of by definition, that makes it a biography. But I felt that the point of the book wasn't really Tanshu's life. I think Tanshu's life is really interesting, and hopefully I convey some of that in the book. But what makes the book, I think, useful as a way of thinking about 20th century China is the intersection of Tanshu's life with these major events that he either observed or took part in or both. And so what became interesting to me was not so much the details of Tanshu's life, and so a biography in that sense, like on what date did this happen and what date did that happen, but rather on how the details of his life interacted with these big events that any student of modern China will get introduced to pretty early in their career. So big events like the Sino-Japanese War or the Russo-Japanese War or the Boxer Uprising or the Japanese invasion or the communist victory in the Civil War. All these are big picture events, and everybody knows, in air quotes, what happened. But of course, no event in history actually takes place except in the experience of individuals who are there. And so it looks different from different perspectives, and it looks different in different people's experiences. And so to me, one thing that I wanted to get at was the importance of Tanshu not as an individual life, but as the portrait of Tanshu as kind of representative of all of the people who taken together make up human experience, which sounds a little bit grand. But nonetheless, I think it's looking at the big arc of history only makes sense if you can then balance that out with the experience of individuals on the ground who are taking part and really comprising that big arc of history.
So one of those individuals is actually you. And you mentioned early in the book, and this is one of the really fascinating historiographical points in addition to what we've already talked about, you mentioned early in the book that the book is in many ways about travel. So not only are you accounting for us and recounting for us Tanshu's travels, but to research the book, you also, to some extent, traveled Tanshu's itinerary. And you mentioned that sharing this experience, to the extent possible, as you put it, brought you closer to understanding the man and better equipped to relate his story. So can you talk about that element of the process for us? What were, first of all, can you just kind of open that up? And also, what were some of the challenges with taking that approach that you found as a historian?
That was both the most enjoyable and the most challenging part of the experience. So early on in the book's genesis, I was really trying to make it sort of equal parts present and past. So it was going to document my travels alongside Tanshu's travels, and they were going to be equally important in how the book was presented. I wasn't able to follow that through for a variety of reasons, but nonetheless, I felt it was really important to keep a foot in the present as well as a foot in the past. So I did think it was important for me to follow Tanshu's footsteps, and I eventually did make it to not exactly every specific place that he got to, but I did make it to at least all of the cities and regions that were important to him. I think there's something to be said for just for place, for the importance of place. One thing that, in your first question about how I came into the field, as a historian, I was, my parents are Texans and Southerners, and I was raised in New England. And so I had this very clear sense that place was an important marker of where people were and where people were from, and that they were made up of those past experiences, not only that they had, but actually that their family and that their people had passed on to them through time. So I felt it was worthwhile to just follow Tanshu around, several decades later, and see how those places might have informed the person that he came to be. And sometimes that took very specific, was very specific. So for instance, it was really important the fact that he was a northerner and yet traveled to the south and became where he could pick up some of these, where he could be trained as a Buddhist monk, but then be sent back to the north because they needed northerners who could speak the language, who could understand the culture. And also Tan Xu wasted no time, expressing his dislike of the South. He didn't like the food. He didn't like the accent. He didn't like the smells. So I thought it was very important. At the same time, traveling around to these different places often left me at loose ends for exactly what I was doing. So, and I would spend weeks in these monasteries. There were texts I could look at, and I did look at some of these texts, and there were people I could interview, and I did interview some of these people. But it wasn't the daily grind of getting up early in the morning, though I did, and going to bed late at night, though I sometimes did, and filling those intervening hours with, going to the library, making photocopies, translating and reading texts. So there was a lot of time spent thinking and contemplating Tan Xu's life and what it meant. And so I think in that way, maybe just gave me more space to think about Tan Xu's life. And so if to the extent that the place where these things actually happened make a difference to our understanding of what they were, then I think it was important. So I would concede that point's not universally accepted by every historian.
Thank you so much. Now, you've already mentioned the importance of places and the places of his life. One of those places was the place that he was born and returned to, at least to some extent, later on in his life, and this was Beitang. So he's born... Or Tan Xu at this point is not Tan Xu. He's born as Wang Shouchun, and he's born in 1875 in Beitang. This is a small fishing community, and you bring us through the early stages of his life, which are, at least as we understand them from the existing record, right, which includes largely his memoir in addition to other kinds of sources. His early life was kind of sprinkled with these moments that later on become significant in light of his ultimate career as a Buddhist monk. And so as a toddler, his first words were the Chinese equivalent of keep vegetarian,
right.
Surrounded by all these signs. So eventually 1892, cholera breaks out. Now he, at this point, is 17. He's about to be married, but perhaps more significantly, and we can talk about that as well, his friend dies and this affects him really deeply. Okay. So he's very deeply affected by his friend's death and then he gets sick. Now I mention this because this is one of those transformative points in the story where we really see the transformation of Tan Xu as a man, as an individual, and as increasingly a figure whose life is marked by these points of metamorphosis that bring him to the spiritual path that he eventually finds himself on. At this point, he gets sick, and according to him, he actually dies and he goes to the underworld. So this is perhaps a good place to begin, is with his death. Can you talk a little bit about this? What happens in the course of this moment for him, and what is significant about what happens that we need to understand in order to understand what you are arguing about his life in this part of the book?
Sure. And you're right. I think it makes all the sense in the world to begin with his death, which is not typical for how narratives work, at least on this mortal plane. So when Tan Xu, let me start with the source a little bit. So obviously all of these stories that you just passed on have to be evaluated, by the historian. So I'm evaluating these claims as I'm reading the source. The main source is his memoir, which he actually dictated to students later in his life. And so it's his memoir which is providing the foundation for a lot of this. And obviously the only person who can understand what happened to him when he died, as he put it forward, is himself. And this can only come from his own view. We don't have any corroborating evidence to prove that he did or did not die in 1892. And he's quite upfront about it in the memoir, and as I relate in the book. I mean, he says, I know what this sounds like. This sounds like, I was sick, I had a high fever, I was hallucinating, and I imagined that I died and all these things happened. And I just want you to understand that while I know it seems that that's what happened. That isn't what happened. I actually died, and then goes on to explain what happened. To me, what's important about that story, there are a few things that are important about that story. So one is I just think it's interesting. So, I mean, it gives you an insight into belief systems and how people think about the afterlife, the underworld, you know, what goes on in these other planes. Because he goes and he has this negotiation with some of the figures in the underworld, eventually persuades them to let him go back. And I just think that story is a little slice of, for people, students of comparative religion or trying to understand that aspect of Chinese society, I think it's a great detail to bring in. You know, the second one, I think historiographically, you know, what do you do with that kind of a source? You know, when he's making a claim that as a, you know, as a secular scholar writing in the 20th and 21st century, you know, what do I do with that? I mean, that clearly can't be true. And yet, the person who I'm taking as my guide, at least to get started in this story, says it is true. So how do you assess that? And I guess that leads me on to probably the most important thing about it, which is that I try to let the reader have the evidence and then make a decision for him or herself. So while it's essential to the story that Tan Xu died, negotiated his way back to Earth, and then came back to life, it's essential to the scholar that can't be true, because we know that those things don't happen, right? That's the rational enlightenment view of the world. So we have these two contradictory forces, something that has to be true and something that cannot be true. And yet I chose to write a book where both of them apparently are functioning. So I present them, I put them out for the reader, and you can decide for yourself how successful it is. But I really try to honor the source by not denying that what he said is true, but I want to also honor the reader and respect the reader by saying, I know how this looks. I'm not making a truth claim for it, but I am saying that it's important to how we understand Tan Xu's life.
Great. Thank you. Now, though he's also newly married at this point, he doesn't actually mention his wife a lot in the account. And does he ever mention her by name?
No, not that I was, and I spent a lot of time looking for that.
So this is only one of many silences that you talk about negotiating through, sort of developing a relationship with over the course of the book. And I want to mark this now as the first of many silences we're going to talk about, but we'll get to it in a little bit more detail in a little bit. Now, he's unhappy in Beitang for all kinds of reasons. He goes to live with cousins in Fengtian and work in a family tobacco business. He has his first, but absolutely not last, as we'll see, experience of war in this time as well. The Japanese attack China in 1894, and this becomes a recurring theme through which we follow his life and through which we understand the unfolding of modern China in this context as we see his life unfolding alongside it. Now, he leaves Beitang, and he goes to find work to support his family. And this is just kind of the beginning of a number of travels that we follow him through over the course of the book. Throughout his life, Wang is actually living in cities that were on Chinese soil, but that are in some way administered by foreigners. And you make this point early in the second chapter. And they're populated mostly by Chinese. Why is this important for us to understand the way that Wang is offering a particular vision of 20th century China? So in other words, what's important about the kinds of cities that he finds himself in and the relationship between sort of Chinese and foreign manifestations of life in those cities for you as an author?
Sure. Well, in a lot of ways, coming out of this book, I really sort of reflected on what it is I am as a historian. And I find that I write a lot about the interaction of China and, you know, the West, although I tend to do that at a personal level and not at a state-to-state level. So it was interesting to me just how these sites of colonialism or semi-colonialism or imperialism, how we negotiate with those places. But one other thing that was important about, I just call him Tan Xu for short, since I know his name changed. He's not yet known as Tan Xu.
Right, that's right.
But one thing that comes up as Tan Xu for him is that Right, this engagement with foreignness, this engagement with the foreign, so mostly the West, but not only the West. You see, the Japanese play a huge role as well. This is not unique to Tan Xu. He's certainly not the only person to say, you know, wow, there's a lot of really interesting and important stuff to understand about these foreigners. But I think what I think comes out about Tan Xu's response is it doesn't fit neatly into any of the categories with which we're more familiar as historians. He's not a modernizer in the sense that he doesn't think they need to reject traditional Chinese culture and embrace something more modern, whether that's Western or whether that's some hybrid of Chinese and Western. So he's not a modernizer, but he's not a xenophobe. He's not saying that we need to get rid of the foreign and return to something more Chinese, like the Boxers might be the classic example of that. He's somebody who thinks that China needs to find a way to compete, and he uses those words. China needs to find a way to strengthen itself, but he does that through an appeal to Buddhism. Eventually, it takes him a little while to get there. So I think that his response to these foreign communities or these mixed foreign and Chinese communities, I think complexifies our understanding of ways that individuals during that time, so from the middle of the 19th into the middle of the 20th century, the way they responded to the foreign presence. It wasn't just in the ways that may have grabbed the headlines.
Great, thank you. So at this point, Tan Xu is still Wang. He's already experienced a name change early in his life, but he's still Wang. So at this point, he's left home. He's in Dalian during a time of increased fighting between Russian and Japanese forces in Manchuria. He flees to escape the fighting, and he winds up in Yingkou. And it's not much more stable in Yingkou. But while in Yingkou, he's sort of continuing to search for the kind of spiritual and religious fulfillment that he's looking for. And he's got a friend, Liu Wenhua, whose story inspires him with the power of Buddhism. So long story short, he goes home, he tells his wife that he's going to the cemetery to tend to his relatives' graves, and instead he leaves and he sets out for Tianjin to become a Buddhist monk. Long story short, again, he finds one master who's actually recently died. That doesn't work out for him. He eventually settles with another master, Di Xian. He takes the tonsure again, and this is where he gets his new name, Tan Xu. Okay, so now he's gotten his name. This is a really important part of the story. Now, he moves from here, and he's still traveling, and he arrives in Ningbo in 1917. So Ningbo is one of the many cities that you talk about in the book that are actually really important as places and as spaces for the unfolding of the history of 20th century China. So can you talk a little bit about Ningbo as Tan Xu is encountering it and sort of maybe what's important for us to understand about the city at this point in the story?
Sure. And at some point, may want to loop back to understanding some of the things that happened in those really eventful, decades leading up to Ningbo.
Oh, sure. If you want to sort of take us there by talking about those decades, that's absolutely fine.
Well, I think we may loop back to it in the next in a minute. So let me address Ningbo. So I think for me, Ningbo, and I was really happy because I got the chance to go to Ningbo, which is a very pleasant place to be. But Tan Xu wouldn't agree with that assessment. He hated it. The reason he hated it was because it was so unfamiliar. And I think that's a really important point to bring out for students who are coming to China or coming to a study of China, that this is not just one place, right? I mean, this is something that we as scholars often take for granted, that people understand the diversity within China proper, in quotes. But for Tan Xu, when he went to Ningbo, he didn't like the food. He didn't understand what people were saying. He didn't like the weather. There were too many mosquitoes. There was really nothing about it that he liked. But it was really important that he go there because, in this period in China's history, that's where all the Buddhism was. So Buddhism was being revived across China, as Holmes Welch wrote about the Buddhist revival. But it's being revived across China, but it really in the north, it had become quite dormant. And so they were very excited, the monks were, to have a northerner who was willing to study, to take the tonsure, to become a monk, and they could send him back to the north to speak with people. So for Tanshu, Ningbo was important as a site where he could really get the credentials that he needed to go become a monk, but it was not some place that he really enjoyed very much personally.
Great, thank you. So there's a lot that's happening, and we won't have time to talk about, clearly, right, all of the things that are happening in all of the chapters. So please feel free to raise any of the important points that I don't think to sure. ask you at any point in the conversation. Okay, so he, as you mentioned, he's invited by this master, his master Dixian, to go north with him. They go to Beijing. Dixian lectures on the Lotus Sutra. Long story short, eventually, by the spring of 1920, Tanshu is again frustrated and he decides to leave the monastery. Again, he lies about the reasons for doing that. He lies to Dixian and he leaves for Shanghai. So over the next couple of chapters, we see Tanshu taking on increasingly public roles to spread Buddhist teaching throughout many Chinese cities, and we see him traveling more and more. He goes, and in the course of these travels, he goes to Yingkou to check on his family. Over the course of this, he sees his wife. He has this encounter with his wife where she finally understands that he's alive, first of all, why he left. She eventually takes up, to some extent, Buddhist practices as well, and she eventually dies, but dies reciting a Buddhist sutra. He gets back to Beijing. He's invited increasingly by temples to lecture in order to attract new students for schools, and he begins to work finding supporters to financially back the construction of Buddhist temples. And this becomes something that he works on more and more as his reputation increases over the course of the book and over the course of his life, and as more and more temples really kind of need that patronage and need that support because of other transformations in 20th century Chinese society that are happening on the heels of and on the back of not just strife and fighting, but also transformations in the political structure of Chinese society at the time. Now, at this point, he's increasingly being sought out by local leaders for his ability to, as you put it in the book, use Buddhism to promote and to strengthen the Chinese nation. So here we have Buddhism and nationalism being used sort of hand in hand as tools that go together. Now, this eventually brings us about midway through the book to a chapter that takes us into a moment where he's, you know, well along the path of these travels, and these travels take him eventually to Harbin. I wanted to stop for a moment and focus on this because you did mention that this is, in many ways, one of the points of origin of the project is your work, your earlier work on Harbin, and this is a really, really important space for this study. This is at this point where he gets to Harbin. It's very much a place of confluence between Russia, Japan, and China, or among, rather, Russia, Japan, and China. So can you take us into Tanshu's Harbin? What is the space as he's experiencing it, and can you help us understand what's important about that, again, for you as an author at this point in the story?
Sure. I mean, I think, as you said, Harbin is where this really began. That's where I first encountered Tanshu, and that's where the general outline of his career became clear to me. Harbin, for any of your listeners who have been to Harbin, they probably, at best, they have a notion of it as an interesting place. It's unlikely they have a very positive impression of it because it's not a really very, very pleasant city to be in. It's a fascinating city, and I think it's one best viewed through historians' eyes. If you go back to the 1920s, which is when Tanshu arrives there, right? It was depending on how you defined it. It was China's most cosmopolitan city. Certain people at Shanghai would rail against that notion, but it was right up there, right? It had symphony orchestras, it had newspapers in a dozen languages, close to a dozen languages anyway. It had consulates and populations from most of the major countries in Europe. It had a very diverse a very diverse student student body, very diverse. Been grading too many exams lately. A very diverse population, and yet, it was very isolated, very much very far away from the rest of China, and so it had grown up in this place. Where it was not officially a Russian colony, but it was kind of a Russian colony. And so when Tanshu arrived there, he came at a moment when it was transforming itself or being transformed from a Russian colony, semi-colony, into a Chinese city, which is what I wrote about in my first book. But in that part of that process was a physical transformation of the city. And this was a pattern that began in Yingkou to a lesser extent, really became fully fledged in Harbin, and then got carried out in Qingdao later on. But if you've, the Buddhist temple in Harbin is located at the end of a broad street. In fact, it's called Broad Straight Street, which goes right down, connects what used to be one of the main Orthodox cathedrals, goes down past the Protestant and Catholic Christian churches, and down to the Russian cemetery, which would have this was kind of the access, kind of a spiritual access for Europeans, especially Russians, but for Europeans in Harbin. The Buddhist temple and the Confucian temple were both built there in the 1920s. Flanking that route, not by coincidence, right? They're built there with the explicit purpose of demonstrating to a non-Chinese population, no, you're not in St. Petersburg anymore, right? So this is the idea that he's trying to promote. Tanshu was brought in to do that. So he built the temple in that particular place, that particular time. So it's a diverse city. It's a city that's majority population is Chinese, but its administration has been almost wholly, well, at least for the central parts of the city, almost wholly Russian or European. And now that changes, I should have made clear, after the Russian Revolution, when the Chinese government doesn't recognize the Soviet Union. So therefore, all of the Russians who are there are rendered stateless. You know, so the Russian Empire is dissolved, but the Soviet Union has not been recognized. So China uses that opportunity in the 1920s to reclaim its authority over Harbin, and Tanshu becomes a central player in that.
Thank you. So over the course of this chapter, among other things that are happening, he founds a temple. This is the Paradise Temple. You take us through the travails of him actually trying to find a patron to support the building and then running of the temple. And this is an adventure of its own, and which involves fire, and this guy claiming to be the Buddha's uncle, and all these kinds of things that are happening around the founding of this temple. Another thing that's happening around the founding of this temple is the Japanese invasion of Manchuria, and in particular the Japanese attack on Harbin. This begins, as you put it in the book, the two decades or nearly two decades of war for Tanshu, and we're going to see the reverberations of a Japanese occupation of China, various areas of China throughout the book, and we'll focus on that again in more detail in a few minutes. But one of the things that's happening with regard to this particular temple is that, among other things, the government actually places a spy, a Japanese spy, in the temple to check in on Tanshu's political activities. And this sort of, the way we understand Tanshu in relationship to politics, political activities with regard to Japan and beyond is going to be a theme that's going to come up again and again for the remainder of the book and in your epilogue as well, or rather in the last part of the book. Mm-hmm. And so I just want to mark this as perhaps one of the clearest places where we begin to see what winds up becoming a recurring theme really take center stage in the story, and we'll return to that shortly. Okay. So as we move throughout the story, Tanshu keeps traveling. He travels to Xi'an. Along the way, he is met with conditions of profound famine in central Shanxi province. He has an ambition in Xi'an to revive a major temple, the Maternal Grace Temple. It's a very expensive project. It's a very historically significant project. In the midst of this, his old master, Di Xian, dies, and he travels back for the memorial. There are pirates, so I just want to mark this for listeners who are particularly interested in pirates, and I know you're out there, listeners, because I am as well. There are pirates.
Murdered by pirates is good.
Exactly. Pirates, chapter 7. But sort of more to the point, he visits Di Xian's shrine, right? He goes there. But he's largely silent in his memoir about the emotional impact on him. And I wanted to take a moment to mark this and to ask you to talk a little bit about it, because sort of dealing as a historian with these silences, this is something that comes up again and again as something that you as an author and a historian seem concerned with throughout the book, and it's something that's very affecting at this part of the book. So can you speak to that, the silences in the story and how you encounter them and navigate your way through them as a historian of Tanshu and beyond?
Yeah, with apologies to Doctor Who, the silence is central, right? I mean, the silence is just really... what shapes really his experience. I can think of, I shouldn't enumerate them because I'm sure I'll have to revise the number, but there are several instances where the silence is deafening, to use a kind of a cliche. So, it begins with his literal silence at his death, or at his death experience, when he writes extensively about it, but he was literally silent, right? When he was not alive. But then he goes on to these other periods when he's very silent about his experience of leaving his family is one that he explains a lot of what he was thinking, but not nearly enough to fully understand what's going on. He's quite silent about his relationship to the Japanese, and how he relates to the Japanese and how he functions. And that's both in Harbin and then later in Qingdao. And then at this moment with Di Xian, he's silent about how this affects him. I try to approach this in a few different ways. So one is, as I mentioned earlier, trying to respect the reader and give the reader some tools for making sense of what had happened. So clearly, I say clearly, I'm imposing some of my own judgment into this. Clearly, this is really emotionally affecting for him. So when he's making these major transitions in his life, they're affecting him extensively, but he's not sharing with us fully how they would have affected him. He does give some insights into it. He says a little bit, but not a great deal. And we can also go back to the source to try and understand why that might be the case, right? He's dictating this memoir for novice monks or for people in training to become monks. And so his focus is on the goal, is on the process, is on their ultimate participation in the Sangha, but it's not about their master's emotional state. So it makes a lot of sense that he would be silent about it. And yet, as a 21st century author, or even more as a 21st century reader, that's, I think, one of the most valuable things about the book, is trying to get some insight into why he behaved the way that he did. So that chapter, the Xi'an chapter, that's really in many ways a social history chapter. It talks about famine, and it talks about it talks about pirates, but it talks about the lawlessness and the different competing political organizations in central China at the time. But I do think that that in the big picture, the most affecting, maybe not the big picture, in the little picture, the most affecting part is his return to Ningbo. After he's missed the services because he was delayed by pirates, and he sits alone with his thoughts about Di Xian, and then and then you turn the page and he's moved on to doing something else. So I can't rely on his word, but that's okay, because his word would be just that. I mean, that would be one piece of evidence, but it wouldn't be the full understanding of what that moment meant. So then the last piece that I always tried to bring in. It's going back to when I was an undergraduate, we read R.G. Collingwood and the idea of history. And Collingwood talked about this notion of the historical imagination. And all historians do this to do this, and is trying to figure out not necessarily what did happen or what must have happened, but trying to understand what was a plausible explanation for the things that he did and what might have motivated him. And we use that by using our own experience and the evidence that we're presented with. And so I try to use those moments of silence, as an opportunity for me as a historian to, I guess ply my trade to try and figure out why he acted the way he did and what was making him do some of those things. But also just as an author to play a little bit with the narrative structure and to respect the audience, the reader enough to let them make their own decisions and not force my interpretation on people as they're reading it. That may be an overly honest approach, or it may be just a frustrating approach. I'm not really sure.
I didn't find it frustrating. So I could just report
excellent
on behalf of one reader. I thought that was great. So as we move further into the story and also into more of the silences, you bring us into a chapter that I'm just going to kind of briefly mark and account for without asking you to talk too much about it, just so that we can get to the Japanese engagement in Chapter 9. But Chapter 8 takes us into one of the most fascinating spaces and places for people who are interested in 20th century China and also 21st century China. This is Qingdao. At this point in the story, it is a space of German influence. It's a vacation spot. And he builds the Tranquil Mountain Temple Memorial Stupa as a kind of Chinese-style building that rises up in the midst of lots of European-style buildings. It's among the largest and most important temples founded as well during this period, where you show us it's not just about Tanshu's practices, but he's practicing Buddhism and he's helping found these temples in the midst of a revival of Buddhism in early 20th century China. And the success that he has in Qingdao helps establish him as one of the key figures in this revival. So this is a really important place for people who are interested in religious history, Buddhist history. Focus on Chapter 8 among the other chapters, but here's where we see a really important moment in the history of religious revival, and he plays a really significant part in that. We move from there into another really fascinating historiographical space, and that is the space of wartime. So Japanese forces invade in the summer of 1937, and you describe this as launching what you call the most controversial and also hardest to decipher period of Tanshu's career. You talk here, and this is why I mention it in the context of silences, about the challenges of making sense of the silence in the memoir in regard to Tanshu's relationship with the occupier. And this becomes really interesting because one of the things that the book is doing at this point is helping us think a little bit more critically about how we articulate relationships with occupying forces in terms of the language that we use and the way we think about those relationships. You urge us to think perhaps beyond the metaphor of or the language of collaboration in terms of what Tanshu was doing. So this is a really fascinating, I think, moment for anybody interested in wartime China in this particular period in 20th century Chinese history, but also in the way that we narrativize and also read narratives of engagement with occupying forces in wartime. So can you talk a little bit about that, the language of collaboration or not, and the challenges of making sense of the silences of Tanshu's own account with regard to understanding his relationship with the Japanese occupiers in this period?
Yeah, you may have to rein me in to get me to talk just a little bit about it.
But talk as much as you'd like.
There's a few, yes, this chapter is really central, from a scholar's point of view and for a student's point of view. Going back to what I said earlier, I think that Tanshu's life is valuable in as much as any life is valuable for its own sake, but it's also really useful because of the way he interacts with these big historical moments. And maybe the biggest is the Second Sino-Japanese War. So he's operating this major temple in this large port city at Qingdao. And we have to, during the Japanese occupation. So how do we make sense of that? And as you mentioned, these categories of collaboration and resistance are the dominant ones for understanding this. And if you look at any situation, whether it's, you know, whether it's France in the Second World War, whether it's the Netherlands in the Second World War, whether it's China, some people are taking up arms and fighting against the enemy. And some people are actively working with the enemy to accomplish their ends. But most people are doing neither of those things. Or maybe most people are doing both these things. I mentioned in the book, I think, and I've mentioned in a lot of conversations, you know, there's a really thoughtful notion by the Czech dissident and president Václav Havel, who talked about the line between collaboration and resistance not passing between individuals but through them. So the idea being that you can't divide people into collaborators and resistors. Anybody who's living in the situation is to some extent or another participating in the system, resisting the system, and making their own negotiation. So that the first thing I want to do is to try and just give some flesh to an individual who was living during this time period and making choices, some of which were probably morally questionable and some of which were probably heroic, but nonetheless living his life. But then, of course, as you mentioned earlier, the silence, you know, crops up again. He says very little about it. And it's curious that he does, because this is an opportunity to shape his narrative. I mean, he may not have been expecting some historian to pick it up a half a century later and try to make a book out of it. But he was trying to present his story to people who were coming after him. So why didn't he present himself in a particularly heroic way? Or why didn't he make this into a teachable moment like he had done? He had done regrettable things, and here's why, or here's how he would have done them differently. He didn't do any of those. And in fact, he goes out of his way, more in Harbin than in Qingdao, but he goes out of his way to say, the Japanese said I was leading the resistance, but that's not true. I wasn't leading the resistance. And these other people, you know, have accused me of being a collaborator, and said, that's not true either. So he dodges the question altogether. So I think that this can easily be called a cop out, but I really think that the only honest way to do it is to present his life and to say, these are some of the things that people did in the situation that put tremendous stress on individual choices, and to say that it was a simple matter of collaboration or resistance, you know, kind of misses the point, that most people are simply trying to make their way, and we all do that with constraints. Most of the time, those constraints are not nearly as severe as occupation by an invading army, but in this case, they are, and here's what he did with it.
Thank you, Jay. Now, as we move into the last parts of the book, a lot of other things happen for Tanchu. American Marines come into the story after the Japanese defeat at the end of World War II. He does more traveling. In the course of one trip, he and his colleagues are actually entertained by Guanyin, as he claims, mm-hmm. which is a really interesting sure. part of the story. And as communist victory becomes more likely, he becomes even more committed to collecting and preserving Buddhist texts. And this ultimately, by the end of the story, is going to resolve into him overseeing the creation of a Buddhist library. But before we get there, we have to meet and sort of get to know a little bit the student who helps make that possible. And this is the student who you actually introduce us to at the very beginning of the book, at the very opening of the story. You've talked a little bit about him already. And he also, he's somebody who, though, we kind of meet and get to know in a little bit more depth toward the end of the story. That's a young student at this point in Qingdao named Lok To, who facilitates not only this wonderful math by which 27 monks make it to Shanghai on 3 tickets, right. which is this fabulous scene, which we could talk about maybe if we have time. But he also facilitates the first plane trip that Tanchu ever makes. He facilitates Tanchu's movement to to Hong Kong, and he facilitates by the end of his life really the creation of this library that Tangshu actually, it's in some ways kind of a legacy for him.
Yeah.
And you bring this out at the end. So can you talk about Lok To for us and sort of take us into his role in this last part of the story?
Yeah, Lok To, you know, since I got to know him, you know, and I have many very fond memories of Lok To, and also some very fraught memories. I mean, he had a stroke not too long after I got to know him, not a serious one, but it made it more difficult to interview him, and actually just didn't really want to because it was very stressful for him. But when I first, for the first couple of years that I was working on the project, I met with Lok To fairly regularly, both to interview and ask him questions about the memoir and about his own memories of Tangshu and also about these temples. But Lok To is also instrumental more broadly for getting his perspective on Buddhism and how that fit into his vision of modern China. And then because, and this is kind of another conversation, but because Lok To, or because where the Chinese government became interested in the 1990s, especially, and later in reviving some of these temples, Lok To is one of the few people who was able to, who could mobilize connections around the world really to help legitimize this project. And so he, you know, he was not only still important to the community in the United States and in Canada, but he was vitally important to communities in Hong Kong, and then he became important to communities back in Qingdao. So he was an essential guide into transforming the project from simply an academic one into being a more academic and personal one. But then in understanding Lok To's life, you know, it in and of itself was quite a journey, and the anecdotes you're describing really have a sense of life to them and give you a strong, when you connect them with the man that I met, you can see. I mean, he was very quick to laugh. He was very engaged with the world. He was not at all sort of the image of kind of a hermited, isolated monk that some people might have for a Buddhist monk. He was very much active and engaged with the world, and obviously very capable when it came to getting things done.
Great. Thank you, Jay. And I have to just take a moment to explain this 27 monks using 3 tickets thing, because I've
read it.
There's this wonderful scene at the end of chapter 9, just for listeners who haven't yet had a chance to read the book. I hope you'll move to this part of the chapter where he's trying to get Tangshu and other monks to Hong Kong. And as part of this, like, yes, they can only afford 3 tickets to get to for passage to Shanghai, from which they will try to then get to Hong Kong. So they only have 3 tickets, but like 27 monks want to go. And so they do this thing where, three monks go on, and then 2 monks go like below deck, but give the remaining 1 monk like their 2 tickets, and then he like smuggles 2 other monks on board, and then they go below deck, and eventually all 27 make it onto the ship. And it's this kind of wonderful, hilarious, but also really moving moment of the story that I just really, really loved. It's one of many moving moments, but I just,
well, something to, you know, something that's lost in our modern world, I think, with the ticket scanners and security checks. I don't think that sort of thing is so likely anymore.
So by the end of the story, again, as I've mentioned, Tangshu gets to Hong Kong. At this point, Hong Kong is in flux, and Tangshu kind of follows the changing sort of texture and the changing history of Hong Kong with his own changing texture, right? So he presides over a new Buddhist seminary, the South China Buddhist Studies Center, and at this point he's the most senior monk in Hong Kong. And you take us through what kind of happens as he's trying to raise money for this center. They try to make socks to make money, no dice there. They try to make money by doing laundry, no dice there. Eventually they're able to support themselves by performing a rite for deliverance of creatures of water and land, a really important Buddhist ritual, which is a really important moment in the history of the finances of a temple. And so it's a really interesting window into how, you know, Buddhist monks are supporting these institutions in the 20th century. And we've talked a little bit about already the creation of the Buddhist Library of South China. And from here, Lakto makes his way to San Francisco and then to New York, the Bronx, where I'm from, actually.
Really?
So we begin at the Bronx and we end in the Bronx as well. Now, in the epilogue, Jay, you tell the story, you sort of bring this story into not just the future, but also into your future, or the kind of epilogue of your experience telling the story as a historian. And you tell the story of a publicity poster that you shared with your contacts at the Young Men's Buddhist Association, and also talk a little bit about the fallout from that poster. I think this is perhaps something that's worth talking a little bit about, because this brings out the kind of issue that we talked about briefly earlier in our conversation,
yeah.
And that's the way to understand Tenshu with regard to political history. So
well,
can you talk about that? Yeah.
Sure. No, I mean, at the very outset, oftentimes the way I frame this book is it's about traveling between and among worlds. And that includes the world of the living and the world of the dead. And it includes physical space, from Dongbei and from the Northeast down to central China and to the Southeast and then on to Hong Kong. But also as an author, it left me between different worlds. So one would include the notion of scholarship versus advocacy. So when I'm working with a lot of these people who are believers and they're giving me access to this material, how does that shape or restrict my actions vis-a-vis those materials? Also, the notion of objectivity is raised there too. If they're, as I just told you, if one of my main sources is somebody who I know, how does that affect the story? It's not unique to this situation, but it's relevant. So then what happened, what you were just asking me about. So right. I was giving a talk on this, at Bryn Mawr College. And, the idea was, I was talking about the intersection of Buddhism and politics, religion and politics and Buddhism and nationalism. I can't remember the exact formulation right now, but definitely religion and politics came up, and I was very excited about it because I did a nice job on the poster, and it's always fun to share your work with others. And I went, as a means of thanking them for their help, I sent this poster on and got back a message that wasn't it wasn't scolding, but it was cool compared to my earlier interactions, and just that they wanted to be clear that Tenshu wasn't political. There's nothing political going on. And I had a schedule to go and meet with them, and they had kind of said that wasn't going to work out. We could reschedule sometime, but I eventually did meet back up with them again, but it took several years. And I think that was instructive to me as a historian, because it's like, well, now I understand why people work with sources that are in the deep past. They don't interact with you. But also I think it was helpful again for me understanding that, the story doesn't end. And in the same way that Tenshu was dealing with difficult ethical, moral, and political decisions from the 1890s all the way into the 1960s when he died. But the ramifications continue. And even today, for instance, that temple in Qingdao, there's a fair amount of controversy over it because it's been nicely renovated, and I stayed there for a couple of weeks when I was doing the research. It's been nicely renovated and is sort of seen as a jewel in the tourist crown of the region. But a lot of monks, especially in Hong Kong and the U.S., are somewhat dismissive of it and other Buddhist sites in the mainland, saying they're really being exploited, they're being used as money-making enterprises, and they're not honoring the spiritual and religious spirit in which they were intended. Now, of course, I can then add another layer onto that by saying, well, even the religious and spiritual context when they were constructed was problematic, right? Because they had a political role at that time as well. So I think it helps to break down some of those bright lines that we have between categories, but also just to reemphasize the contingent and constantly changing nature of the way that people interact with one another, i.e. politics.
Well, Jay, thank you so much for making the time to talk with me about the book. I usually end with two questions, but I'm going to add a third one onto the end here because it seems particularly appropriate given the nature of the book and the really beautiful and very evocative way that it's written. So the writing style of the book is very fluid. It's the kind of style that makes this history come alive for a reader in a way that many histories of 20th century China don't. And I can envision it being used in lots of different kinds of contexts, including in the classroom. So what is your vision for how the book, how you'd like to see the book used? And what do you envision the kind of audience being for the book? And can you, in what ways do you imagine it being used in a classroom setting?
Sure. Well, thanks for that compliment. And I'm hoping that it's, I hope that the book is readable. And I think that, I do think because of what I said earlier, that I see this as a way of sort of getting at aspects of society in modern China, or rather getting at aspects of the big arc, but how that big arc is reflected and refracted through the life of an individual. I think that the book would go well and, in teaching about 20th century China, if you've got big books that talk about the big trends, and then you have smaller books to complement it. When we talk about small films, I think this is a small book. And this would, there's other, much better examples of people who've done this, but people like Henrietta Harrison's Man Awakened from Dreams, or going back further, Jonathan Spence's Death of Woman Wong, but books that far surpass my ambitions for this one, but books that look at the lives of individuals and how they fit into specific contexts and really make sense of, okay, the Ming Qing conquest is this, but here's how it played out in the life of an individual, or the transition to from Republic to People's Republic, or the Japanese invasion, or any of the other different events, how they play out. So I think it's useful in that sense. I also hope that if some of what I've played around with genre and biography and microhistory, those things, lots of authors are doing that. I'm far from unique in that, but it would be interesting to see the book paired with some of those others. In fact, I've done some of that in my own classes, looking at Robert Bicker's work, and also with some novels and mentioned Henrietta Harrison, some different ways of getting at lives, kind of Chinese lives, to borrow that title, and how we have examples of not just what it might have been like for people to live through these big events, but actually what it was like for them to live through these big events.
So Jay, we've talked a lot about a lot of aspects of the book, but of course there were a ton of things in the book that we didn't have a chance to talk about. Is there anything in particular that we didn't have a chance to talk about, but that you'd like to mention for listeners?
I actually really think we hit on just about all of them. I think that so much of the book is trying to fill in gaps and fill in holes that the main source is silent on. So I would urge the reader to take this as a book that is about really the spaces as well as the form. And I think you did a great job guiding through that, although we could, of course, go through each and every example. But I think they got the picture.
So now that the book is out and the paperback also just came out, so congratulations on both of those. What's next for you? What project or projects are currently inspiring you?
Well, I'm really excited by the work that I'm getting to do now. So, as I mentioned earlier, I've come to sort of own my identity as sort of a historian of China and the West, or China's interactions with the other, at a personal level. And so what I've kind of settled on now is I'm working on a project that's set at the racetrack in Shanghai in the 1940s. So actually, and to be specific, in November of 1941. So the idea is that I'm going to take one day, and it's the day that was the last champions race run at the racetrack before the Japanese invaded. Well, not before they invaded China, of course, but before they invade the international settlement, which doesn't happen until, what Americans think of as Pearl Harbor, right? When they attack Hong Kong and other Western outpost. So this one day, I'm starting in the morning, going through to the evening, and it just so happens that this day was Sun Yat-sen's birthday, so there was stuff going on associated with that. Liza Hardoon, who was the widow of Silas Hardoon, one of the wealthiest men in all of China, her funeral was that same day, and documenting sort of how the life of the city went on or didn't go on at this kind of liminal moment there when the war had started but yet hadn't fully enveloped the international settlement, and then really the last lights of this colonial society, and trying to evaluate what that meant and what it was like just as it was about to change, period.
Oh my God, I love it. Okay, email me when that's out and we'll talk about that too. What a great, great project. So Jay, thank you so much. It's really been a pleasure. It was a pleasure to read the book, and it's also really a special pleasure for me whenever I have a chance to talk to a historian who's clearly also very self-reflexive and self-aware as a writer. So thank you for all of these things. Best of luck and have fun at the racetrack.
Well, thank you so much, and thanks for the opportunity.
You've been listening to New Books in East Asian Studies. Thanks very much for joining us, and we'll see you next time.